The reading is taken from John chapter 5, verses 2 to 15, and can be found on page 1068 of the Church Bibles. Now, there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I am trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath, and so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well.
Tonight we're continuing our sermon series from John's Gospel. And last week Simon reminded us that John is far more selective than the other Gospels when it comes to Jesus' miracles. And this wasn't because John wasn't interested in the other miracles, rather he deliberately chose to highlight just seven of them because he believed they revealed something really important about Jesus. And John called them signs, and I think this is a great definition, because a sign always points us towards something or someone. And John's focus was always on Jesus, who he was, and what he came to do. So John 20, 30 to 31, Jesus did many other miraculous signs which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So at the wedding in Cana, the climax of the story is not that the water was changed into wine, although that's what people tend to remember, but that his disciples were changed. John 2:11, this was the first of Jesus' miraculous signs. He thus revealed his glory and his disciples put their faith in him. And the healing of the royal official's son, which Simon spoke about last week, is similar. John 4:53-54, so the royal official and all his household believed. For John, the important thing is not so much the miracle, but more that people should see beyond it to the source and come to believe in Jesus. Well, tonight we're looking at another healing, and this one took place at the Pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem. And in fact, there were two pools there, separated by a dividing wall, and they were used originally as reservoirs to supply the temple with water. And they were also a place where people could bathe. Now, I don't know how many of you have got your Bibles open at that passage, but if you have, you'll see that the passage jumps from verse 3 to verse 5. Hang on a moment, you might say. What happened to verse 4? Well, if you look in our copy of the Bible, verse 4 is included. It's at the bottom as a footnote because it only appeared in later translations. And so people thought, well, is this part of the original or not? But the verse 4 that is sort of in a sense not missing, because we know it from later documents, but it's not in the main text, says this: "From time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters. The first one into the pool after such a disturbance would be cured." That's John 5, verse 4. And the cynical amongst us might say there's a far more rational explanation. It's that there was a spring that bubbled up occasionally, and when it did, it brought nutrients and minerals into the water, which were really beneficial for the first person to get into the water, because as soon as everyone else joined him, he would then catch any of the germs that they were adding to the water when they got into the water. But, I mean, that's just a theory, and it doesn't really matter for the purposes of what we're doing tonight. But essentially, the people around the pool were trusting that if they could get into the water when the waters were moved, that they would be healed. And the word Bethesda has actually got two meanings. I was quite surprised by this. I thought, surely, you know, most words have one clear meaning. And the significance of the two meanings is that they're total opposites. So the first is house of mercy or house of grace, and the second is house of shame, house of disgrace. And I thought that that was perfect for John's story of Jesus, because he came into our world and he went to Bethesda to bring grace instead of disgrace and mercy instead of shame. Because at the time, sickness and disability were abhorrent. I mean, still nowadays, some people are not very good with handling people who are sick or disabled. It was often considered to be the result of sin. For example, in John 9:2, the disciples asked Jesus about a blind man, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" So the sick were to be avoided at all costs. In the story of the Good Samaritan, the priest and Levite walked past the man who'd been attacked and left for dead because they didn't want to be defiled. God-fearing Jews would go to all sorts of lengths to keep ritually clean. When I was on holiday many years ago now in Jerusalem, I accidentally wandered into an Orthodox district, and a group of Hasidic Jews shouted at me, really quite loudly, and gestured at me to leave. Even though I was modestly dressed and wasn't behaving disrespectfully, just the sight of a Gentile woman was abhorrent to them. Well, Jesus didn't have that problem. He happily mixed with anybody. As a result, the Pharisees accused him of partying with sinners, Matthew 9, 10 to 12. Jesus didn't avoid sick people. He reached out, he touched them, and he made them well, Matthew 8, 3. And John's story of the sick man is no exception. In John 5, 3, the colonnade was crowded with a great number of disabled people, and Jesus was right there in the middle of them. And remember, it was the Sabbath. As a rabbi, Jesus should have been on his way to the temple, doing everything possible to avoid contamination. Instead, he had chosen to go to the one place where no one would dream of going. It was a place of desolation and hopelessness. Despite the crowd who surrounded him, the sick man felt isolated and alone. It appears that his family had also deserted him. John 5, 7, "I have no one to help me." His only hope was to reach the water, and he couldn't get near it. Suddenly, Jesus approached him. Why did Jesus single out this particular man among so many? What made Jesus notice him? If we look just a few verses further ahead to John 5, 19, Jesus himself gives us the answer. "The Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does." I bet as Jesus was walking through the colonnade, he was praying, "Father, who do you want me to see? Who do you want me to bless today in your name? Show me." And then this man caught his eye. He had lain there for 38 years, a lifetime of begging, waiting, and hoping. And frankly, he didn't seem to have much hope left when Jesus spoke to him. "Do you want to get well?" That's John 5, verse 6. Just look at the man's reply, or rather, look at what he doesn't say. Because he doesn't say yes. You would think that was the obvious answer. Frankly, if it was me and I had been ill for that long, I imagine I would have said something like this. "Don't be stupid. Of course I want to get well. But I'm not that man. And I haven't been sick for 38 years, abandoned by my family, living from hand to mouth, surrounded by a crowd of people in a similar hopeless situation. I cannot begin to imagine what this man's physical and mental condition was like. But I suspect he was completely ground down by it." And our translation calls him an invalid. And I thought, I wonder what the problem was that he had. Because John doesn't actually say he was paralyzed. You know, that wasn't the reason he couldn't get into the pool. He didn't use a word that our English translation picks up that gives him a definite condition. So I was a bit of a Greek geek. Greek geek, that sounds rather good, doesn't it? And I looked up what the Greek word was in the text. And the word that John uses for our word invalid is weakness. So obviously he had some sort of condition that made him incredibly weak. And whatever it was that had caused his illness hadn't been improved by 38 years of inactivity. If any of you have ever been unwell for a long time, or you know, you've been in bed for a long time because you've maybe had an operation or something and you've got to rest, or you're not meant to put weight on your body, you get weaker and weaker. Inactivity makes you weak. Your muscles waste away. Perhaps that was what had happened to this guy. And the man also couldn't imagine anything different. I think that was part of the problem. He'd been ill for so long, he couldn't imagine that he could ever be better. So what looks to us like a string of excuses is actually the reality that's inside this man's head. "Sir, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I am trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." The man's one mistake, well, not his only one, I'm sure, but, you know, the man's one serious mistake was that he'd forgotten that it's God who heals. It's not a special spring of water. The man was looking in the wrong direction for help. And what he didn't know was that God was looking at him, because Jesus was looking at him, and Jesus was about to change his life in an instant. And I smile, because if you look at the Gospels, every healing story is different. It's like God is saying, "I do it differently every time, so don't try and find a formula that's going to work. Don't try and work out what it is that I do so that you can do it. You've just got to take it from me. It's going to be different every time." So the man didn't even know who Jesus was. He hadn't asked Jesus to help him. Jesus didn't engage in a long theological discussion about healing with him. He just told the man to get up, pick up his mat and walk. And he did. It was totally unexpected, amazing, unconditional grace. And off he went, with no suggestion of a thank you or a backward glance, while Jesus slipped away into the crowd unnoticed and unobserved. The crowd didn't spot Jesus. Nor did they notice that this beggar who had lain helpless for 38 years was now miraculously well and strong enough to carry his mat. How could that have happened? Here's the thing. I think the rest of the crowd were also so busy watching the pool, because they were waiting for the waters to move and they didn't know when it would happen, and when it happened, they didn't want to miss it, that they actually totally missed seeing what God was doing. They were expecting healing to happen in one way, and they didn't see that God was doing it another way. But if the crowd hadn't spotted the man carrying his mat, the Jewish leaders had, and they pounced. John 5:10, it's the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat. But the man didn't know who Jesus was. And it rather sounds as if he's passing the blame onto Jesus. He quickly replies, the man who made me well said to me, pick up your mat and walk. What's so desperately sad is that the Jewish leaders were not remotely interested in the fact that the man had been healed. All they wanted to know was who had caused him to break the Sabbath rules. John 5:12 to 13. Who is this fellow? I love it. This fellow, the man. They have no idea who he is. Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk? But the man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. And the story could actually have ended there with Jesus remaining undiscovered. But Jesus encountered the man once again, this time at the temple, and Jesus challenged him. John 5:14, see, you are well again. Stop sinning, lest something worse may happen to you. Remember that Jesus only said what the Father told him. So clearly God had given Jesus some sort of insight into the man's spiritual condition. And we don't know, it's really frustrating, we don't know how the man responded to Jesus. Did he accept that he was a sinner? Did he fall at Jesus' feet and beg for mercy? Did he become reconciled with Jesus? Did he understand at last that Jesus wasn't just offering him healing, but was offering him freedom from sin and eternal life? We don't know. But what we do know is that he went and told the authorities, who used this as an excuse to step up their persecution. John 5:16 to 18, which we didn't hear read to us, continues the story. So, because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jews persecuted him. Jesus said to them, my Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working. For this reason, the Jews tried all the harder to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. The Pharisees had totally missed the point. The Lord of the Sabbath was right there among them, yet they didn't recognize him. Their kind of Sabbath was something that God never intended. It was joyless, judgmental, nitpicking legalism. Jesus' version was more like a grace party. And we are all invited to join in with him. All week, I've been struggling to write the end of this sermon because John always writes in lots and lots of layers. He puts in lots of layers of meaning, lots of wonderful detail. I love John because of that, just as Simon loves Mark because Mark is very logical, all very orderly, and it moves very quickly from one thing to another. And John sort of swirls round and round, a bit like a plane hovering above Heathrow and that's waiting to land. And it just goes round and round at different levels and then maybe goes back up again and then comes down and then goes round. And all the time, John is weaving in all these extra details. So the danger is you want to talk about all of them. But something happened to me this morning at the 9 o'clock service when I was presiding at communion, and I was completely overcome with tears. Some of you were here and you know that. And it was just as I broke the bread, I just had this realization that Jesus was broken on the cross because he didn't want any of us to be broken. That was why he didn't want us to be broken. So he willingly gave himself to be broken. And I'm really glad we've had communion tonight. But the truth is, we're all broken to one degree or another, whether by sin or sickness or just life circumstances. And we all need to be made whole. We all need the life-giving grace that Jesus offers. All the people who were around the pool at Bethesda needed Jesus. The Pharisees needed Jesus. The Jewish people needed Jesus. We need Jesus. God's heart is still for the broken. And actually, that means that we who serve Jesus need to take God's grace with us wherever we go, whether it's to work or to college or school or home. We need to pray each day as Jesus prayed. Where do you want me to go? Who do you want me to bless? What do you want me to say? What do you want me to do? We may find ourselves having the most unexpected conversations with the most unexpected people in the most unexpected places. Maybe Jesus wants some of us actually to go to some of the dark places, to go to the places where no one else is willing to go. I find that really challenging. But maybe that's what he's saying to me and to you. Who else is going to go into these dark places? Only Jesus went into them. The Pharisees weren't there. The people who thought they were whole and healthy weren't there. Only Jesus was willing to go there because he knew they needed grace. Maybe if we don't go into some of the dark places in our community, they'll never know. They'll never hear. Because people want to talk about life's big issues. They're always looking for someone to listen to their story. They're always looking for answers. They're always looking for compassion. It's just a question of getting into conversation with people. I was at a 60th birthday party on Friday night on the River Thames on a boat. When you're on a boat for 4 hours, you can't go anywhere. And you talk to those around you. And I found myself having the most profound conversations with people because they say, well, what do you do? So you tell them. And then they say, well, I went to church once. And I say, okay, what happened? And then they start telling me what happened. And you end up going in all sorts of places with them. And then you encourage them, and if it's possible, you sort of say, I'm going to pray for you. I wasn't able to pray with them actually on the boat, but I did say to a couple of people, I'm going to pray for you. And they were so grateful. So we just need to be a bit bolder about talking about God. Because actually, when you say to someone, if they've just shared all their troubles with you, can I pray for you? Very few people actually say no. I'm trying to think. I think at least one person in my life has said no to me when I've said, can I pray for you? And everyone else has said yes. And I'm now getting much bolder about saying, can I say a prayer for you now? And it's amazing how people say, oh, sure. I think they don't know what I'm going to do, but they soon find out. And actually, it's really exciting because you think, well, if I hadn't stopped and had that conversation with that person, they wouldn't be being blessed by Jesus. And the times when I say to God, who do you want me to see? Who do you want me to talk to? I do find myself bumping into people. And I just think, oh, God, you're doing it again, aren't you? And then we get into this conversation and it all happens again. So I just want to encourage you that we need to be bolder. This is what we're called to do. We're called to carry the grace that we've received out there. And we may be being called to go into the dark places where no one else will go. Not everybody will necessarily be called to do that. That's why I'm just saying that quite carefully. Also, this passage speaks to me about God's unconditional love and grace, which seeks us out regardless of whether we say yes to him or not. And it struck me again tonight when I relived the story with you that we don't know what the final response of the man was. But it didn't stop God kicking off with some fantastic grace. God didn't say, well, I'm just going to wait until you've made a commitment to me and confessed all your sin and understood the theology of healing, and then I'm going to bless you. Jesus just blessed the man. And he didn't wait for the stuff that we sometimes wait for before we bless people. So we need to be unconditional lovers and givers of grace. We need to give grace to people regardless of whether they accept it or not. And they may never say yes to Jesus or not. We just don't know. The man had been sick for 38 years and his illness had lasted so long. This is my final thing. His illness had lasted so long that he got to the point where he didn't believe his situation could ever change. He'd got stuck in hopelessness. And I wondered if tonight someone here feels stuck in some way, whether it's in a relationship that's not right, or a work situation that's not right, or that you're just not seeing progress on a particular thing that you really, really want. Maybe like the man, you also feel isolated and alone with no one to help you. Maybe you're looking for answers in the wrong place. Maybe you used to believe, but you got sucked into a dark place and you no longer know if you can trust Jesus. But just as Jesus was standing right in front of the man, looking at him and loving him, I think God is here tonight, standing in the midst of us, and he sees all of us and he loves all of us, and he sees a heart. He knows what our heart's desires are. And I just want to encourage you to come for prayer and to see how God's grace might bless you and free you and bless you even more and free you even more. And then I just want to encourage you to take that blessing and freedom out into the world with you. Amen.